You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 23 is, what is the relationship between culture and nature? And we read Jean-Jacques Rousseau's Discourse on Inequality from 1754. And also, we'll touch on his book one of The Social Contract from 1762. For links to online versions of these works, as well as discussion and other information, please check out partiallyexaminedlife.com. My name is Mark Linton-Meyer, broadcasting to you from Madison, Wisconsin.
And this is Seth Paskin, hanging with you from Austin, Texas.
And this is Wes Allen in Boston, Massachusetts.
I like that. So we sounded like increasingly stoned, where I was very straight, and then Seth was hanging, and then you were just barely present.
I'm trying to remember what city I lived in.
Probably a fair representation of our states of mind, I would guess.
Hey, we haven't done the rules for a couple episodes, so let me do that quick.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, here are some ground rules we try to follow in our discussions. If you want more information on it, go look at our blog or on iTunes for our episode zero. So number one, we try not to assume our audience knows anything about any of this. Number two, no gratuitous name dropping. We are interested in ideas, not with fetishizing dead philosophers. If we have a point to make, we'll make it, and not say, for instance, you would know what I mean had you only read Pat Morita's There Is No Karate Try, A Study in Ontology.
Ooh.
Is that too obscure?
No, it's good.
I get the reference.
All right. Number three, we shall be rigorous and exact in all that we say, though we shall, at the same time, make wildly incoherent gestures.
So I'm going to just throw this out there for discussion prior to getting into Jean-Jacques, that perhaps...
I like that we should call him Jean-Jacques throughout.
I do too. I think we should start using first names for everybody. How well are we doing at adhering to rule number one?
Well, apparently the last episode, even though at least one person said it was our best ever, there were a lot of names flying around, and I could see how people would have trouble with that. However, if you go look at the blog... I posted a bunch of videos so you could get to know each of those people, almost all of them, individually, and what kind of weirdos they are. So that might help with that particular episode. Otherwise, we're probably doing fine.
All right. I just think that perhaps I should try to act like there's always somebody who's naive who has to say, oh, well, what does that mean in real terms? Can you give me an example? I may try to start playing that role a little bit more.
Well, good.
Especially when an ism comes into play. Like, oh, that's functionalism. Oh. That's, you know, cognitive determinism or whatever all that shit was. And I was like, really? Okay. What does that cash out to? So, anyway.
We could use a little more enforcement. I think you're right, Seth.
Yeah, but we're not going to have to worry about it in this episode, I don't think.
No.
The Philosophy of Mind episode that I was just referring to, that I was really surprised that we worked our way through that much material at all, and somewhat gracefully. So,
we knew that had the potential to be a huge mess, and I think it came out pretty well considering. So
this is much less ambitious.
I just can't believe that anybody would listen to 2.5 hours of us going on and on about something. That's the part
bizarre.
That I guess.
Yes, but we had Marco.
Well, that's true. Marco's dulcet tones.
I will sit through an hour of these bastards to hear a few smooth sentences from that accent.
There you go. Is that how we appeal to the female portion of our audience? We read in Marco the Wise and his dulcet tones.
That's right. Italian accent.
Gets them every time.
So we chose the Discourse on Equality as our main work, which is not Jean-Jacques' most well-known work, right?
Correct.
On Wes's recommendation, and I was kind of happy about that because when I finally did get into a little of The Social Contract, it was a lot harder and less fun. So this
is
a good one.
It's much more boring. Yeah. Who wants to talk about the general will? I want to talk about how civilization sucks.
Yes. He's very pissy and negative in this whole thing. That's fun. Yeah.
Well, I think the first thing is we got to talk a little bit about him. I mean, he's got this reputation for being a little bit of a lunatic, a genius, a polymath, being rural, like a nostalgia, go back to nature, but also simultaneously advocating for the civil society. He was accused by Hannah Arendt and others of being basically the progenitor of fascism. I mean, he's a very controversial and interesting character. At points in time in his life, was exiled from France and went and lived in a house near David Hume. And Hume was like kind of a defender of his, even though he was at that point going insane and started to abuse Hume because he was paranoid. But Hume was out to get him.
And they were lovers.
Now, are you throwing that in? Or
yeah, I'm bullshitting. That's right. I remember that from our Hume episode where they were friends. And then, yeah, Rousseau became paranoid.
Anyway, he's a fascinating character. Absolutely fascinating. So at first, when I first started reading this, and I was like, oh, why didn't we do this right after Hobbes? True. Like, why are we just getting back to this now?
Yeah, I guess we should say the readers, we'll probably talk enough about Hobbes here that you don't have to go back and listen to the Hobbes episode, but you might.
He's touching on the same problem in the Discourse on Inequality and the Social Contract that Hobbes touches on in Leviathan. And he refers to Hobbes, although he also refers to other people. Anyway, he's a fascinating guy, and deservedly so. And we might be reading his fourth most famous book. This isn't even the one he's most famous for. It's like, no, hardly even makes the list.
No, it does. No, I think it's read as almost as frequently as Social Contract.
What about Emile?
Well, I mean, who can get through that?
I'm just saying, it's famous.
Emile is like Ulysses. It's famous, but I don't know how often it's assigned.
That's a work of fiction, but here there's some philosophical content.
It's half fiction, half philosophy. I think it's divided into two parts. One's fiction, one's philosophical.
I've never read it.
Yeah, neither have I. My mom wants me to read it, whatever that means. Education of a Child.
And this work, I have a little note here from Wikipedia, written in 1754 in response to a prize competition of the Academy of Dijon, answering the prompt, "What is the origin of inequality among men, and is it authorized by natural law?" So he had won he had been recognized by the prize committee for another one of these earlier, his Discourse on the Arts and Sciences, but they didn't like this one as much. This one did not win.
And this also exceeded the word length requirements.
So they just probably didn't even read it. I had a philosophy paper one of my undergrad TAs did that with. It was on Descartes' Meditations, and I wrote a big long thing, and she's like, I only wanted 5 pages, so I just stopped there.
I had a teacher in elementary school who, if you had to write a book report or whatever that was like 7 pages long, you'd do it, and on the day that they were due, he would just walk by everybody's desk and count the number of pages that had writing on them.
Well, that's nice. So you learned to bloviate early.
No, I was too much of a good kid, and when I didn't actually do the work, I got bad grades because I tried to be true to the spirit and not the letter of the law.
What age was this around? What grade?
This would have been like 4th or 5th grade.
Okay.
So whatever that is.
Because I distinctly remember in 3rd grade, they had a caterpillar going around the wall posted toward the ceiling, which every time somebody read a book, then they would get to put a new circle on the caterpillar with the name of the book and, you know, that it was them and stuff. And I thought that was the shit. I really wanted some more circles. So I, in fact, invented at least one book just out of nothing and filled out the form that constituted a book report. I remember it was called Bananas, 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 and I made an author's name so I could get my extra caterpillar.
See, this
thorax.
Goes precisely to Rousseau's point that the desire for recognition leads to deception.
Thank you so much for linking that up with something relevant. I appreciate it.
And look at how early that desire is inculcated in today's youth. Yesterday's youth, I guess we count as. We're not even today's youth. By the way, I would just say to anybody who goes out and looks on the Wikipedia page at the Rousseau entry that whoever wrote the section on this particular part, the theory of natural man, is definitely like a Rousseau apologist.
And you might be better off looking at the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy, Stanford's poor cousin.
Okay.
Fewer entries, but they're good. They're quality and more basic, but better than Wikipedia.
So we need a quick synopsis. What is this about?
All right. I've tried to condense this down into like the most synopsis ever. So I'll try. How about I try and do that? And if someone else wants to give one after I fail to do that, then that's cool.
You want me to put the timer on you?
All right. Yeah, but maybe that would be a good... And then just stop listening after my...
You're preempting our jokes, dude.
Rousseau is worried about the origins of inequality in society and wealth and social status and
so on. And he's thinking of things in terms of natural right and states of nature. And specifically, we talked about Hobbes before, where the idea is that the state of nature is nasty, brutish, and short, and it's basically the strong rule of weak. And then societies come about as a way to remedy this. Well, Rousseau is going to turn that on its head and say that, in fact, the state of nature, meaning human beings before they've been socialized, or what he calls savages.
Like the people of the Caribbean, as he often refers to.
Yes.
Racist bastard.
Oh, my God.
He's going to say that they're happy and healthy and, in fact, doing very well until the advent of social relations. And that's where, once society comes about, once civilization comes about, that's where we start to get inequality and vices and everything else that we lament. Where does society come from? In the second part of the essay, he sort of try and trace how we get from this state of nature and happiness to the evil civilization as we know it. I think the basic way to describe all of that is that it comes about with our reflectiveness and self-awareness, which, while it leads to all our improvements and advancements in technology, also leads to this kind of sense of pride and basically the awareness of relative strength and weakness. So it's one thing to have natural abilities in the state of nature. It's another to be aware of them and then to become aware that others are aware of them and that you can sort of use them for mutual assistance or that others may be harmful to you. And that concept of mutual assistance leads to social structures and to property and to tighter social relations between people, familial relations, and to the valuation of public esteem and recognition, circles around caterpillars, all that stuff. And then to taking offense at disrespect. So once you start to value the recognition of others, then you can take offense when that recognition isn't provided. And then on the other side of things, you get division of labor and a sort of amplification of the inequality in natural abilities, which don't mean that much in a state of nature, but they mean a lot when there's a division of labor because some people gain a lot more by doing the same work. And so you get inequalities in wealth. And then the final step is because of all those divisions, as they rise up socially, there's a sort of zero-sum game going on between the more powerful and the less powerful. The rich are worried about, you know, being overthrown by revolution, and the weak are kind of miserable. So the rich sort of invent this ideology, which essentially enslaves everyone, which is that we'll come up with a concept of law and justice, which will protect everyone. And that's where we'll put the power so that no particular person or class has it. But for Rousseau, of course, that just institutionalizes the whole scheme, which subjects everyone to the slavery of society. So,
yeah, that's pretty good. He took Hobbes's picture of people in the state of nature having a terrible time and they make this compact. He actually uses that. He still has a compact in there. He still acknowledges the nasty state that's pre-full-scale civilization. But he says that that's much later. He traced a few steps before that. He just says Hobbes's picture is not complicated enough.
His state of nature already assumes social relations, already assumes a socialized being, right?
Yeah, that's his criticism of all philosophers to this point who've talked about the state of nature have transferred their own ideas of society onto their conceptions of what the state of nature is and then sort of snuck them in and brought them back. Because he doesn't fundamentally disagree with Hobbes that the individual's sense of self-preservation or desire for self-preservation is kind of the one constant. He just thinks that the environment in which the individual is trying to self-preserve is very, very different. And that people in general are more or less indifferent to others insofar as they don't intrude upon them, as opposed to being constantly in a state of war and living in fear of having their shit taken, which he says is something that only comes about once you have injustice.
Right. And then there is the one added element. There is that desire for self-preservation, but there's also the principle of empathy at work. That's pre-social.
Yeah.
Pre-reflective, it doesn't require reason. So those two principles. But I think he thinks the instinct of self-preservation isn't going to lead to that many ills anyway.
Which I think it was good that we read this rather than The Social Contract, because I remember looking at the beginning of The Social Contract and he starts by saying something like, you know, serving your self-interest being primary and sort of building on that. He's not talking anymore there about the state of nature. He's talking about sort of in society when we're just trying to figure out what government we're going to have, given that we're already right. in society.
How to make the best of a bad situation, which
yes,
it's not all clear that he thinks it's that bad in the social contract.
And then he thinks even for primitive people, pursuing your own survival is still the primary thing, but that's different than egoism. He yes. wants to distinguish between what self-respect and self-love. It was different in different translations. Of course, we do what we need to do to survive, but like Hobbes thinks that the only way to make sure you survive is to just grind everybody else down so low that they have no chance of taking your stuff. And he just thinks that that's completely foreign to the savage nature, to human nature itself. But, you know, if you see somebody else get hurt, that's terrible. And that's something that Hobbes or all the folks that just say, oh, nobody's ever altruistic, everybody just does, is selfish, they don't seem to have recognition of.
I love the way he describes the fact that, you know, not only do the what he calls the brutes have empathy, do animals have empathy, but even like the most depraved human beings. And, you know, he gives examples of, say, some Roman emperor who's indifferent to the slaughter of thousands of people, but can go into a theater and see some sad story and cry at it. So even in these sort of depraved human beings who seem like they are completely lacking in empathy, in fact, the empathy is still there, and it's a certain social condition which deadens it in some situation.
Yeah, which I thought about that, like watching Schindler's List or something, and you ask, like, oh, how could people treat people as horribly as the concentration camp guards treated their prisoners? Well, yeah. That's because it was, they didn't see them as human anymore. They, you know, really got themselves mind fucked so that they put these people in a certain category so that they weren't people and they didn't have to empathize with them. And that's like something that they had to be conditioned into.
Yeah.
Is that as much time as it took to bring up a Nazi example?
It was a movie example. That's okay.
I know.
It's okay to bring up Nazis as long as it's Nazi movies.
No, it's just...
I think it's okay to bring up Nazis in general.
You know how I feel about using that as a limit case example. All right, so a couple of things I kind of want to point out just to lay some groundwork here. When we talked about Hobbes in our previous episode, which our faithful listeners will know about, and for those of you who are listening to this for the first time, you can go back and listen to, Hobbes proposed this idea of the state of nature, which is prior to civilization. What is it like for people to live outside of civil society? And one of the things that's kind of unclear in his analysis, or at least to us it was, is whether he was actually saying that this is the way it was, or is this just a thought experiment to try and hypothesize about the nature of natural law and natural rights and how societies get formed and how societal or conventional rights can come on top of natural rights. One of the things that Rousseau does, which I think is very good, is that he says, I'm not going to let the facts actually intrude. I think he uses that turn of phrase. I will not let the facts intrude upon what I'm saying. He basically says this is purely hypothetical and speculative, and that I'm just sort of theorizing about what things are like. And it's a thought experiment in that respect. Now, two things about that. One is that he was much more aware, apparently, than Hobbes was about the behaviors of these so-called indigenous societies that obviously influenced his, let's just call it, naive views of people like the Caribs, right? We can call his racist views about them, but he was doing this as a thought experiment.
Is it racist if they're a favorable views? It's still racist, but he's like, they have good love lives, they relax, they're...
Exactly. And it's naive and very sort of like Eurocentric.
Really good resorts.
Eurocentric. But at least he acknowledges that. Because I had a hard time when I was reading this. I was like, really? Are you really going to go there? You're really going to say that? You're really going to defend that? But I'm trying to put it in context to understand that. So the other thing is that he romanticizes these so-called pre-civil society cultures. He says it early on in part one of the discourse, the savage man is strong and not subject to illness, whereas civilized man is, you know, weak and effeminate. Primitive man, the aborigines of Australia, they don't have these problems, right? Because they're tough and strong. And they don't get sick, they don't have the flu, and they don't worry about bird flu and mad cow disease and all these other sorts of things. And I think that obviously contributed to this view of him as the pastoral romanticist,
which
it's kind of also laying the foundation for what he's going to try to build off of, because he is going to try to build this story about how culturalization and the entering into civil society creates all these ills, including inequality. So it's important as a context, I think.
If I would just walk outside now and try to walk the dog for more than a minute and a half, then I feel like his whole picture of the savage as being happy with his lot is a load of crap, unless the savage does not live in an area with a lot of mosquitoes.
The savage is naturally repelled mosquitoes.
It's because they're because their diet. That's right.
Because of their diet, the their sweat was naturally anti-mosquito.
That having been said, Rousseau agrees with Hobbes and some of the other state of nature guys that the one fundamental principle, what you might call the one fundamental natural right that exists in the state of nature, is that of self-preservation. That's what I read out of that. Do you guys agree that that's what he's saying?
Well, he says two principles at some point, right? And then he says self-preservation and empathy.
He says we are born free as soon as we are old enough to care for ourselves. And this is sort of toward the end of the essay and in Social Contract, that we have the right and indeed the obligation, and this is very Kantian, and Kant was very influenced by him, that it is the essence of our humanity to be free, to be self-reliant in a certain way. You cannot abrogate yourself of that right.
Self-reliance or self-preservation?
I think at different parts he's talking about different things. I didn't notice early on him actually referring to self-preservation as a right. Certainly it's one of the tendencies that we have.
You're right.
And Hobbes uses the word right about that. Hobbes used it in a really strange way, and we weren't really even sure what he was talking about. Because he also says, and this is the way Rousseau interprets him, that Hobbes says that we have the right to everything, right? We have to do whatever we think is necessary to preserve ourselves, which again, he thinks that the savage man, Hobbes thinks, will have to essentially kill everybody else to really secure that.
This part where he talks about empathy or compassion, you know, he says there's another principle which has escaped Hobbes, which, having been bestowed on mankind to moderate on certain occasions the impetuosity of egoism, or before its birth, the desire for self-preservation, is the repugnance at seeing a fellow creature suffer. You know, I'm speaking of compassion. He talks about Hobbesian self-preservation, then he adds this principle of empathy.
I wanted to get around to that point about compassion, Wes, but I think there's a distinction here about this concept of preservation. He's not disagreeing with Hobbes that self-preservation is the principal activity of the individual in the state of nature. Self-preservation is kind of the principal goal of human activity in the state of nature, whereas Hobbes said it's your right. Hobbes said self-preservation is a natural right, your natural right. And of course, since self-preservation includes protection from being impinged upon by all these other influences, you have a right to basically establish your dominion aggressively and violently as you see fit. Rousseau is saying there really is no such thing as right, you know, or virtue and vice and those sorts of things. That it's simply the case that self-preservation is what people do in the state of nature, and that self-preservation is not a particularly aggressive activity. In the state of nature, it's pretty easy for people to just kind of do their own thing and get along, and they have no inclination to enforce their will upon others in order to preemptively secure their self-preservation as if it were a right. Where, in fact, the opposite, as Wes pointed out, that it's impossible not to feel compassion for others, even though your primary interest is self-preservation, you also have this inclination to compassion. More importantly, there are no rights, so to speak, in the sense that there's such a thing as a natural right, and that there's a natural right for you to self-preserve. It's just simply an instinct. That right doesn't exist in the state.
Yeah, I think Rousseau and Hobbes are both inconsistent about this idea of, are there moral truths or the normative claims before society comes into the picture? Because Hobbes, on the one hand, uses the word right in the way you're saying, but then he also says, once the state is formed, the social compact is what grounds all further right, and in fact, grounds the definition of right, so that the sovereign is the one who decides from then on what is right and wrong, right? He believes whatever the sovereign defines morality, essentially, is at least one interpretation of Hobbes, whereas Rousseau has a similar kind of thing, that most of our moral considerations and what we consider virtues and vices and things, all that comes up with society. Of course, those are socially created. But then in other places, he talks in the same way. You know, we are born free. We are born with this right or duty of freedom, of duty to act out our humanity as free agents or something like that. So I'm not sure ultimately when you can use the word right.
That's true. That's ambiguous. What's not ambiguous is his, where he comes down about the concept of inequality. But
yeah,
I can agree with that.
Let's talk about that. So he does believe that there are natural inequalities. Some people run faster than others. Some people hunt better than others, whatever. But he thinks that once you get in society, not only do people notice those and start taking offense about those or whatever, but it also exacerbates them, so that if one savage is a little smarter than another, it's not that big a deal. They're not going to have that big an advantage. But then if you put them both in a public school system and one of them is not getting the hand-holding that he needs to excel, and the other one is bright enough that he can figure it out and work through it, then the intellectual difference between them magnifies greatly.
Or more importantly, if one of them is a much better public speaker and gains honor and recognition, or the other one doesn't.
Right. There are more opportunities for these natural things to play out into concrete power differentials.
Right.
And sometimes he does sound like a social Darwinist about that. Like, oh, well, at a certain stage, then the people who are the better, who are the more industrious, then they're able to take advantage of that situation and put themselves on top.
But there is no on top in a state of nature, though, right?
No, I'm talking once you get into, when society is solidifying.
He does give his own little sort of account of how we get from complete state of nature into society. It might be worth just spending a little bit of time on that so that we don't lose the distinction.
Well, that's the whole second part, right?
Yeah, because he does have a very interesting idea where he thinks in the state of nature, human beings are very much like animals in the sense that males and females come together only to copulate and raise young. And when the young are old enough to move on, that they lose all interest, you know, in each other and move on to the next thing, which is kind right. of, I thought that it was amusing.
Yeah, not probably based on the best science.
Well, yeah.
Given
no,
that,
but
like,
I mean,
wolves mate well, for life, and, you know, there are plenty of instances in nature that...
Yes, it was clearly not even informed by, I'm sure, what science and zoology was available even in the day, but I still thought it was kind of interesting. But it's important to him because he thinks that if you're talking about the state of nature related to an individual, where an individual is only doing what they can accomplish and confine themselves only to what they do themselves and is only concerned with their own self-preservation, this idea of the family unit is the first association of individuals into a collective. It is the basis, ultimately, for civil society because it's the first and only real natural association of individuals into a collective. Again, you can disagree with whether or not that's the case, but that's his view.
He really doesn't give a lot of room in his view for psychological dependence, does he? It all just comes down to, yeah, of course, kids that can't take care of themselves are going to be dependent on their parents. But even them, it's a matter of getting what they need to survive, not a matter of being personally attached to each other.
Well, you know, he talks about the development of personal attachment.
The development.
I mean, initially, it's survival. And then you get this, he calls it, quote unquote, the expansion of the human heart, where you get conjugal love and you get parental affection, and that comes about as a result of proximity where you're living in the same dwelling together.
Well, it's just interesting that in the state of nature, he doesn't think that slavery is possible, as opposed to, I guess I normally see Hegel's view, you know, the master and slave view, as the subsequent historical development that improved on all these social contract guys. But yet it seems like Rousseau is saying something that might be an advance upon oversimplifying Hegel's view is that society starts when one guy bashes another guy over the head and sort of makes him his slave, that you get these tribes that are sort of strict tyrannies. Yeah, I don't know if Hegel says this could be...
You say Rousseau is saying that?
No, that's Hegel's view.
Oh.
Whereas Rousseau is saying that's not possible. In fact, if one person tries to take another a slave, I mean, the slaver is going to have to go to sleep at some point, and then the slave just runs away. Whereas it seems like pack dogs... They're not all necessarily related. They're not all necessarily from the same litter, but some can dominate others, and it creates these social relations, non-linguistic social relations, you know, where some are just perpetually cowed by others and seem to accept the subservient role.
you know, I was reminded of Hegel too, in the sense that, especially when I tried to boil it all down, you know, this sort of critical point of self-awareness, right? He calls it reflection at some point, self-awareness and self-love, and then the awareness of that in others. So that's where you get the sort of Hegelian mutual recognition and the building up of the social. So at the same time mm-hmm. that you get these social relations that are necessary to self-consciousness and essential to, you know, who we are as human beings, you get this, I think, something corresponding to the life-death struggle between Hegel's master and slave. It's naturally adversarial because you're trying to win recognition from the other and you're engaged in this game, and that's where all the ills come from. The thing which is, seems to be most distinctively human, reason, and the source of all our, you know, virtues for, say, someone like Aristotle, I think for Rousseau is the source of all our vices and all our problems.
Mm. You know, I didn't read it quite the same way. I'm going to take leave of this little evolutionary act that he takes, which I thought was kind of interesting and probably in a lot of ways more realistic than, you know, than what we saw in Hobbes, for example. But if, as Marx says, for Hegel, the beginning of society is when one guy bashes another guy over the head and makes him a slave, then for Rousseau, the beginning of society is when somebody stands on a piece of land and says, this is mine. Property mm-hmm. and the declaration of ownership of property is the foundation of civil society. You know, really what happens is when somebody figures out that you can mine ore and turn it into metal, or you can take a plot of land and cultivate it. So in other words, anything that you do, labor that you do now, which has no immediate gain, but is for future gain. So it's not hunting and gathering or fishing or whatever, that it's something different. Like that activity is the beginning of civil society because yeah. you have to be able to have the freedom and the space to do it. You have to have the time and the leisure and the protection of your own work that you put in. You have specialized labor, particularly in like mining, for example, metallurgy and agriculture.
Right.
Right.
But Seth, that actually, in the second part, property, even though he begins by saying the famous line where the first person to enclose a piece of ground is the real founder of civil society, he then goes back and gives that whole tracing of going from the state of nature to civil society, and property actually comes about a little later. And so you do get the whole self-awareness thing before property. Because the first instances of property are the hut for mm-hmm. enclosing your family, and yep. then the land for tilling and cattle. Those don't come about until people are actually in little proto-societies. Because one of the reasons why agriculture comes about, for instance, is because if you have some people working on metallurgy, which is necessary to other arts, not everyone is going to be able to contribute to the subsistence within this little hunter-gatherer group. So you already have a proto-social group. But for that to even begin, for there even to be property, you have to have what he calls reflection or self-awareness.
Yeah, no, I get what you're talking about. I mean, in fact, what he says is housing is the first notion of property. So if you go from being the solitary hunter-gatherer to copulating with a member of the opposite sex in order to bear children, presumably, at some point, it was just simply copulation, and the females were required to, you know, who knows what the mating rituals and patterns were for Neanderthal and Cro-Magnon. I don't know, and I don't really want to get into it. But at some point, the male takes it upon himself to build a hut because the female is going to have to give birth and then tend to the young. And that's really the very first inkling of property, the very first inkling of the division of labor from this hunter-gatherer concept. But it also introduces the idea of, oh, well, look, I don't have to do this by myself. There are other couples, there are other groups of individuals who are all going to be doing the same activity, and we should all get together and put our huts pretty close together. Still my hut. But I can walk over to Bob's hut or Jane's hut or whatever, and we'll all just have huts near each other. And he says, therewith comes leisure,
yeah,
which we then use to furnish ourselves with conveniences, which, yep. you know, presumably, which he says are the source of many ills. So, of course, you know, singing and dancing, playing the flute and drums, you know, all that stuff, that's what we do to fill the time. like presumably because now we built these houses and now we aren't out hunting and walking and gathering all the time. And of course, some people are better singers and some people are better dancers than others. And then you're going to get jealousy and recognition and honor, which is going to introduce all this idea, first step towards inequality and vice. So I don't know if we can disentangle the concept of property and leisure. His idea is simply that once you get beyond sustenance living, which is to say being an animal, once you get beyond that and you have time to sit around and think about stuff and come up with time wasters and all that and think that something might belong to you, that's kind of the introduction of all of the ills of society and ultimately equality.
Yeah.
Once you can come up with Sudoku that...
But, you know, I'm still at the beginning of the second part where he's tracing all of this. I find it hard to get. I had to reread that a few times, the first like two or three pages. You know, like, how do we get to the social part? That's really what I wanted to figure out, right? Granted that once we become social and once the recognition of others becomes important to us, then we're in for some problems. But I wanted to see how he got from the state of nature to that social part. And it's a really odd account because it starts out with him talking about self-preservation and then competition for survival with other animals. And he talks about population increase. He talks about, I don't know if you remember this, the demands of different seasons, different geographies. And then he gets to this point where he talks about, quote unquote, relevance of all these things to himself, of all these various beings, of all these contingencies and the perceptions of the relations between them and between himself and them and the fact that he's stronger than animals, which seems to be, oddly enough, that first level of reflection is man's concept, and this is very biblical, but is man's conception of his dominance over the animals. And then he talks about, I don't know if you remember this, but the setting of traps for them and what he calls tricks and the quote-unquote first emotion of pride, which is over animals. And that I found to be a really interesting way to try and get us to be social, because then the next step there is that pride and dominance, then he looks at others and he, so here's a quote, inferred that their manner of thinking and acting was altogether in conformity with his own, specifically that they also had this awareness, they also felt this pride. And if we go back to the genealogy of morals, Nietzsche calls this pathos of, quote unquote, pathos of distance, this sense of power, the sense of superiority. I just thought that was very interesting as sort of the attempt at a Big Bang theory for going from this asocial state to the social state.
Well, he starts off, you know, after talking about just man as an animal running around by himself. Before we get at property, you can't say property is, you know, the mark of the beginning of situation, because the conception of property requires so much. And he has that section on language that really kind of goes nowhere. And he concludes that he has no freaking idea because he thinks.
and then he comes back to language later on again.
Right. So. But he says you couldn't really have language worked out without already having society. Yet you couldn't have society without having language. So that was an interesting little dead end there. But he's at least trying. He's trying to be, even though he's just a terrible anthropologist, he's trying to go back to the beginning, far before Hobbes or any of these folks were considering, and see how from the ground up a human could be built. It's an interesting exercise.
Yeah, he's not going to let the facts get in the way. I mean, he's just, like he says, who knows? We're just speculating. He's just trying to tell a story. But he, you know, ultimately thinks he's going to get to some very important principles, I guess, at some point.
So, yeah, I think this is sort of the Cartesian social meditation, right? What do we strip? Try and like do a thought experiment where you strip human beings of all their social elements. So I think that's cool.
Yeah. So, but I mean, I think we've touched on a couple points. Let me throw them together. His conception is that the quote-unquote state of nature involves the solitary individual, and that solitary individual is concerned with self-preservation, but not aggressive and violent and trying to aggressively sort of step out and defend in the same way that Hobbes says. In fact, the individual has compassion for others in this state of nature. And some way, whether it's through property, familial associations, or pride over tricking animals, there's this introduction of concepts of association or relations with other individuals that gets started. And that's really the point he wants to try to make, is that there is a point at which we find a need to associate with other individuals. And it's really in the association with others that's the genesis for all of the good of civil society and all of the ill that constitutes civil society, which is ultimately the purpose of this essay, which is inequality. Where does it come from?
Yeah.
It comes from the association with others and the sorts of activities that come out of that.
But it's mostly ill, by the way.
Yes.
He parenthetically puts, meaning a few good things and a lot of bad things.
Yes.
Sure. And so
I thought that was funny.
Well, and you know, one of the things that I thought was interesting with respect to Wes's point about industry is that I'm pretty sure he lays out the labor theory of value.
Yes, yeah. I was going to say that in the state of nature, things are abundant. Yeah. And you might get in a conflict with somebody over some meat, but really, if you lose the conflict, it doesn't become personal. You don't try to get revenge. You just go find some other meat. There's plenty of meat right. lying around.
Well, he talks about the idea of mixing your labor with, like, in cultivation, specifically in agriculture. That
that's the only way something can become property.
The only way something can become property, or at least one of the principles that's required, is that you mix your labor with the land to cultivate it. And I was very curious about this. And, you know, he lived near Hume for that period of time, and Adam Smith was a contemporary of the two of them and also in Scotland at the time. But Discourse on Inequality was written in 1754, and Wealth of Nations was not written until 1776. I think it's interesting because he may very well, maybe one of the criticisms in the Wikipedia entry is that Rousseau wasn't an original thinker. He used a lot of other people's ideas, but he put them together in kind of interesting ways. So I was curious if this was his idea or somebody else's, but it definitely is there.
Well, the three of them were actually, they had a podcast for a while, and then Rousseau stole me.
That would have been pretty badass.
That's a good point. That's interesting. Yeah, who came up with it first? Yeah, and then Marx, of course, was all over Rousseau, right?
Yes, very much so.
There's an interesting thing in the stages of civilization here that he actually feels like it's not just that once you start hanging around people that things get mostly bad, that when it's in its really early state, when you know, we have these impromptu joinings for mutual interest, right? Hunting together, and you don't need much language, but you get rudimentary language, you get some tool use, things get a little easier, you get these shelters and the families living under one roof, difference between hunting and gathering, these other things with sexes, with the singing and dancing, that he actually thinks this is mostly a good stage, that things don't, he says, here's a quote, though men had become less patient and their natural compassion had already suffered some diminution, this period of expansion of the human faculties, keeping a just mean between the indolence of the primitive state and the petulant activity of our egoism, must have been the happiest and most stable of epochs. So I thought that was interesting. And this is what he thinks, like, the Caribs, the Caribbean folks are still more or less at. So there is some, like, ooh, you're a better dancer than me. And, you know, there's vanity and envy and things. You know, so there's some negative stuff in it, but it doesn't yet overwhelm. It doesn't make everybody an enemy of everybody else. It's only when we really start to mutually depend on each other. It's not the mutual association just, it's the mutual dependence for our very lives.
Right. Yeah. He calls that the mean between the indolence of the primitive state and the petulant activity of our egoism. Which I thought to be cool. But yeah, that was interesting because what he had described up to that point sounded pretty bad to me. And then he sort of says, but this was actually the golden mean. You know, this was sort of the best combination of humanity and the pre-social or pre-human.
It's interesting that the noble savage concept, which is what, you know, the chief phrase that I hear associated with Rousseau, really isn't anywhere in here. That the indolence of the primitive state, like those primitives are not the noble savages. Like maybe these guys that he's talking about are at this early stage of civilization are the noble savages, but they're not savage according to what he was saying. So it doesn't sound like that's his
phrase. Well, I'm not sure that he thinks indolence is such a bad thing, or even that even though you get all this evil stuff, you get all the higher human qualities, you know, like appreciation of beauty, for instance, that comes about once we leave the state of nature. But he didn't say much about the positive side, right?
You think philosophy would be in there. But yeah, when he explicitly
he talks about it contemptuously.
What are you doing, dude?
It's for how our empathy can leave us. Yeah. The philosopher puts his fingers in his ears and says la 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 to not hear the suffering of those outside his room or something like that. That surprised me when he brought it up to the Caribs and said, this is where it's at. And then from there, it gets really bad. But that's still pre-agriculture, right? That's still hunter-gatherer.
Yes, that's right. Like you're saying, the agricultural and metalworking is when people become seriously dependent on each other, when slavery becomes actually possible.
There's that great phrase, slavery and misery were soon seen to germinate and grow up with the crops. I thought that was a great, great image.
So once this gets really developed, then you get serious competition and everybody really becomes the potential enemy of everybody else. And this is what he thinks corresponds to what Hume must have been talking about when he was saying state of nature. It's really quite an advanced stage of civilization. And at this point, the ones who have acquired the most property, who have parlayed their natural skill in organizing people or working hard or whatever to their advantage so that they have more than others. And they're the ones that have something to lose then, like all this chaos that's going on around them and everybody resenting each other and taking violent actions against each other. So they are the ones that propose, for our mutual safety, we have to accept this social contract, which in fact then just solidifies their material superiority over the others.
Right. How does he put that? He has a great way.
Like dupes are easy to find or something?
Well, he talks about it's like the greatest sham or something that anyone put over...
I see. To this end, after having shown his neighbors the horror of a situation which aimed them against each other, which made their possessions as burdensome as their needs, and in which no one found safety either in poverty or wealth, he easily invented plausible reasons for leading them to his goal. Let us unite, he said to them, to protect the weak from oppression, to restrain the ambitious, and to assure each person of the possession of what belongs to him. Let us institute rules of justice and peace, to which all are obligated to conform, that favor no one in particular, and that in some way make amends for the caprices of fortune by subjecting equally the powerful and the weak to mutual duties. In the next paragraph, far fewer words than these were needed to win over crude, easily seduced men who had furthermore too many difficulties to clear up among themselves to be able to do without arbitrators and too much avarice and ambition to be able to do without masters for long.
Yeah.
All ran headlong into their chains, hoping to ensure their liberty.
Yeah.
So there's the social contract. So whereas Hobbes makes that the current foundation, like why you should obey the sovereign, because you have implicitly agreed to this social contract, Rousseau is going to keep that language, but say we are suckered into this social contract. And certainly this isn't anything that you could pass on to your descendants, you know, that they would have to renew it constantly. This is something in the social contract essay, he says.
The thing I wanted to quote, which doesn't sound that great now, but the rich man, thus urged by necessity, conceived at length the profoundest plan that ever entered the mind of man. Which is to convince the weak that we can institute justice for all. Which is sort of, that's the opposite of Nietzsche's take on it, right? Where the weak are the ones who establish morality for their own benefit.
They establish morality for their own benefit as a reaction to the strong having already established their own morality, right? Which excludes them. So that's not really their own ethics.
It's not a morality for the strong. It's just
their code of virtue.
The strong dominate the weak, and then the slave morality comes about as a way to say certain things are evil and certain things should be punished. And so here, I think the ideology emanates from the, and this is kind of what Marx will say too, it's the rich who come up with all of this stuff to bamboozle the poor, or the strong to bamboozle the weak. And for Nietzsche, it's the weak who are using ideology to get one over on the strong, people who would otherwise simply dominate. No?
Right, because Rousseau says that it just, and this is again from the social contract essay, where he says something like, right from might doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, well, he's arguing against, apparently, there must have been some prevalent theories at the time about the right of conquest or the right of the powerful, the right of strength. And he says the conquest of the powerful or the association of the weak can't really be the origin of political society. This is in order to, it's a counter argument against, like other theories. And he says a right of conquest isn't a right. It can't found other rights. Vanquishers and vanquished remain at war. Violence cannot be the founding principle of any real society because there's no right involved. Simply, just like you said earlier, Mark, as soon as you go to sleep, somebody's going to rise up and kill you. Or as soon as they become strong enough, they'll kill you. Right. And it's the same thing about the association of the people who are being oppressed. all they're doing is exerting desire for self-preservation. And if they aren't strong enough to do it now, when they get strong enough, they will. There's no rights involved.
Right. If you said might makes right, then yes, it would be right for the strong to be oppressing the weak. But then as soon as the weak rise up and smash down the strong, well, that's right for them to do too. So like there's no moral upshot at all.
No. And you may be the strongest one today, but there may be somebody else stronger that comes tomorrow. And suddenly they're now the right ones.
He does say, he says, you know, all natural right is derived from two principles. And then he says that does the compassion, self-preservation thing. So I think he agrees with Hobbes that natural right is derived from self-preservation. It's just that self-preservation doesn't really involve domination, because there is no such thing as domination before you get to the social part of things. So it's not like the social can be derived from relations of domination and conquest and all that stuff, because that doesn't even come about until the social, right? So to say it's right of conquest gets it exactly backwards. There's no such thing as conquest until we're in a social state. So for Hobbes, it would be a right because there's, you know, like Marx said, we have a right to everything for Hobbes in the state of nature. It's might makes right. Rousseau, it's not, no, there is no might makes right because that's not the way self-preservation works. You know, someone takes your tree, you go to the next tree.
Yep. And he has a couple of other comments there. But one of the things that I thought he said that was interesting too is that right of conquest isn't a right. Strong and weak, as used in these theories, are really ambiguous, but they boil down to rich and poor. And he says, and really when it comes down to it, the poor really only have their liberty, and it would be the most absurd thing for them to hand it over to somebody else in exchange for nothing. He's trying to disassemble the idea of the master-slave, that people would voluntarily enter into power relations with others as the subordinate or the oppressed in order to be quote-unquote protected or secure or whatever. You know, it's like, that's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
If you're in that relation, it's because you're not strong enough to be out of it. And if you get strong enough to be out of it, you will get out of it. And that's all there is to it.
Well, the concepts of protection and security require concepts of property and mutual dependence, right? Because otherwise you could just flee. It's only after you've sort of, you know, all the land has been taken up and things have become a zero-sum game and there's all this property that
your family can be held hostage.
Yeah, or domination even makes sense because until you're dependent on someone, they can't dominate you. Well, you know, again, move to the next tree. It's when there are no next trees to move to that you're in trouble. So it doesn't make sense that that someone in a state of nature where they have all those options would say, oh yeah, I'm going to just give up my liberty now, you know, even though I have no property. No, there has to be property first. There has to be all of that stuff first. So it's not like property, you know, again, like Hobbes, I think, and Locke try and derive property from the social compact, when in fact, Rousseau is saying, no, property is required even for that to come about.
And I'm trying to think of, like, which movie this is a quote from. Like, you know why he's so dangerous? Because he has nothing left to lose.
In a world.
You know, we jumped a little to the, once this bamboozled, this original pact was made, that's sort of where the discourse more or less wraps up. And then the social contract kind of is the first place where he gives some sort of positive, well, how could a society actually be legitimate? Whereas in this one, he seems to say, the society is inherently illegitimate. And I just found a quote here flipping through his works, which actually is from a different work, Discourse on Political Economy, which says, let us summarize in a few words the social pact between the two estates. Right, the rich and the poor. You need me, for I am rich and you are poor. Let us make an agreement between us. I shall permit you to have the honor of serving me on the condition that you give me what little you have left in return for the trouble I shall be taking to command you.
That's great.
He's a snarky bastard. It's
power of the people, baby. Yeah, that's why I like this essay better than the Social Contract, where basically, Social Contract, you know, you're no longer in the sort of adolescent fuck society phase. That's when you've reached your 30s and you have a family and you just say, all right, I used to be a hippie, but now I have to, you know, get a job and make a living and just accept things and figure out how to make it work.
Now, I didn't go very far into the Social Contract essay, but I did find it interesting that he's still much more pessimistic about the capacity for having legitimate government than somebody like Locke is. And he talks about Locke specifically, like Locke would say, the social contract we enter in with the sovereign. The sovereign will look out for our interests. And if the sovereign is not looking out for the general will, is not looking out for our interests, then we have the right, even the obligation, to depose the sovereign.
Mm-hmm.
right, is what Locke thinks. Whereas for Rousseau, like the few times that he talks about rebellions, he doesn't seem to have a very positive outlook on what a rebellion or revolution is going to accomplish. It's not going to take down a tyrant and put up something truly representative in its place. It's going to be just turmoil and shit. So like we need to figure out something that will actually be stable and not that like requires rebellion as part of the everyday workings of government whenever the king is doing something bad, which Locke seems to imply that we need institutions. And ultimately what he comes down for is he wants a representative democracy. And it seems to get in a lot of difficulties on how exactly this needs to work out that, I don't know, maybe we can read more of the social contract, more of his details on that when we do a Locke episode on this topic.
That's a good idea. Man is born free and everywhere he is in chains.
Anybody have anything else from the latter part of The Origin of Inequality?
We haven't quite touched on the despotism, you know, sort of the closing the circle.
Oh, yes.
So this is sort of an extension of it's the right of conquest doesn't come first. In fact, it comes last. It's the closing of the circle where the state of nature was sort of, you know, there were natural inequalities in strength. And then those were magnified by division of labor, right? Someone who's more talented or stronger now can actually earn a lot more for the same work. That doesn't happen in the state of nature. And then the extension of that is this complete despotism, which is like a regression to that those natural inequalities, except they're leveraged in this corrupt way. So you get tyrants and you get the rule of the weak over the strong. It's like a return to a state of nature, but of course it's devoid of all that innocence and it's not innocuous.
Right. He seems to think power corrupts. So as soon as you set up, you know, even if when you start your society, the powerful to whom you've given more power are trying to do things that at least give lip service to serving the common good, that this will quickly dissolve and you'll get tyranny inevitably.
Yeah. So the progression is from the establishment of laws and property to what he calls the institution of the magistracy, right? So there's got to be enforcement of laws. Mm-hmm. And then the conversion of legitimate enforcement of laws into arbitrary power. And that's sort of the progression from rich poor to strong weak to master slave.
Yes.
And I love the way he talks about it's in fact the sort of the weak are complicit in all of this because, you know, he says individuals only allow themselves to be oppressed so far as they are hurried on by blind ambition and looking rather below than above them, come to love authority more than independence and submit to slavery that they may in turn enslave others. And it's no easy matter to reduce to obedience a man who has no ambition to command.
Yep.
That idea I like because I think you see it, you know, it's sort of the what about Kansas principle you see in American politics where people vote against their interest, right? Because they identify with the rich, they identify with the strong, even if they're poor, even if they're politically weak. And that's because they have this fantasy that one day they are going to get wealthy. They are going to climb the status ladder. And then the laws that they're voting for will, in fact, benefit them. So it's more important for them to identify with the strong and vote against their interests than it actually is to vote for their own interests.
That's what I thought of when I read it.
There's definitely the tail end of that second part of the essay and, of course, the appendix. You know, really give credence to this view of Rousseau being anti-society and this pastoral, like this, because he basically says that, I'll quote, "If this were the place to go into details, I could readily explain how, even without the intervention of government, inequality of credit and authority become unavoidable among private persons." Mm-hmm. And basically, we are unable to judge pretty exactly how far people has departed from its primitive constitution and of its progress towards the extreme term of corruption. I could explain how much this universal desire for reputation, honors, and advancement, which inflames us all, exercises and holds up to the comparison of our faculties and powers. Civilized man is always moving, sweating, toiling, and racking his brains to find still more laborious occupations.
Yes.
He goes on in drudgery to his last moment and even seeks death to put himself in a position to live or renounce life to acquire immortality. He pays his court to men in power whom he hates and to the wealthy whom he despises. He stops at nothing to have the honor of serving them. He is not ashamed to value himself on his own meanness and their protection. And proud of his slavery, he speaks with disdain of those who have not the honor of sharing it.
Yeah, that's great.
it's pretty clear coming out of this why his books were banned and he was forced to flee the country at that time.
You know, I should point out that not only do the oppressed end up with a bad time in this developed society, but the ones who are on top. So he has a footnote here, and maybe this is the appendix you're referring to, but where he's talking about luxury. Luxury is a remedy much worse than the evil it claims to cure, or rather it is itself the worst of all the evils in any state, whether large or small, which in order to maintain the throngs of valets and wretches it has created overwhelms and ruins the plowman and the citizen. You know, so it goes along with what he was saying before. Every time you create a convenience, right, that saves you manual labor, well, then we become softer and less healthy. And so going on in that, that opulence really makes you miserable and corrupt and degraded, makes the whole society, and this sounds very much like Nietzsche, that it makes the whole society soft and decadent.
But he means something very broad by luxury, right? Because he's thinking all like of leisure as well, from society, just the point right after where you read, from society and luxury to which he gives birth arise the liberal and mechanical arts, commerce, letters, and all those superfluities which make industry flourish and enrich and ruin nations. So I think he's even talking about the kinds of stuff that we would value and we wouldn't want to give up, right? You know, all the arts and the literature and philosophy, all of that stuff, I think he thinks is part of the corruption.
Nowhere more obvious than the iPad.
Which I used to read this, by the way. No, but I think even his own, you know, his own work has to fall within the realm of what he, I think he thinks it's, you know, I mean, obviously he's not advocating that we go back to a state of nature or even to the sort of in-between status of the Caribbeans, but I think he wants us to sort of face up to the bad that's inherent even in all our, I think he says at one point, even inherent in what we call virtue and friendship. Yeah, this is around the same page that we've just been reading, but that deception and vice are in fact part of what we think of as the noblest things: honor, friendship, virtue. So it's a pretty bleak view in that sense of...
Yep. Let's see if we can wrap up any thoughts on the discourse on inequality before saying a little more about the social contract, because he really does sort of start on some separate topics that we can at least look a little bit into. I'm not sure if I can forgive Rousseau his bullshit method. Even though he says it's bullshit, and so I have a quote here, I acknowledge that the events I have to describe could have happened in various ways. I can make up my mind only through conjectures, but beside the fact that these conjectures become reasons when they are the most probable that can be derived from the nature of things and the sole means of discovering the truth, the consequences that I want to deduce from mine will not for that reason be conjectural, since, on the basis of the principles I have just established, no other system could be formulated which would not furnish me with the same results and from which I could not draw the same conclusions. In other words, even if I'm wrong about the exact way that society progressed, I'm still right about my view of human nature and what that means in terms of our verdict about government. Really? I'm supposed to just accept that, oh, well, if I had given 10 other accounts, they would have let me draw the same conclusions and I'd still be able to say the same thing about human nature and government. Like, that's too much faith on my part.
See, I like bullshit. You know me.
It's interesting, and it is, he does have some insight on human nature that I appreciate, but he gets in such detail that there are practical consequences you draw from this that I, you know, you could write many a farcical novel or movie based on people trying to appropriate his fanciful view of the good life in nature and what that means for our current. Yeah, we can't go back to being savages, but you know, what concrete steps should we take? Well, we should exercise a lot and eat natural foods and maybe, hey, maybe they had something right when they were all, he talks about the relations between the sexes that, like, yeah, people just had sex whenever they kind of felt like it and they didn't care who their partner was and they probably didn't even recognize their partner later. Like, this sounds like wish fulfillment hippie talk.
So he should have lived in the 60s, basically.
Exactly. I was reminded of this book I read about the 60s hippies. T.C. Boyle's Drop City is an amusing read.
T.C. Boyle before. Yeah.
Yes, he's almost always pretty amusing and writes these very well-researched I guess, pieces of historical fiction, and just talks about how this plays out, this free attitude towards sex, and what it really ends up being is kind of a method for men to impose their will on women, that like, right, hey babe, if you don't want to be considered an uptight bitch, then you have to have sex with anybody who asks, no matter how skanky and unwashed they may be.
Yeah. Yep.
So I'm not sure what conclusions I'm supposed to draw from Rousseau saying some of these things. And I don't know if I like some of those conclusions that I think he would probably agree with. What do you think? The natural life.
Seth, what's your wrap-up on this?
Is it polemic?
Hey, it was 1754. So I'm going to give the guy a little bit of latitude for a thought experiment. He was basically trying to say there's no such thing as a natural state that causes inequality. In other words, if you're saying that there are people who are naturally born to be slaves, you're wrong. If you think people are naturally born to be violent and dominate others and be dominated, you're wrong. And my account is as plausible as anybody who's providing any other account. And so I think that's really as far as that goes for me. I think there's a tone, though, in the essay of really, really, really a true hostility to society, and maybe like a kind of what you might call bourgeois or courtly society, you know, where this concept of honor and self-aggrandizement and...
Mm-hmm.
I totally see where this view that he was nostalgic for some lost past and the noble savage and pastoral life and all that sort of thing. I get it. But at the same time, it's pretty clear that he's saying there's no such thing as morality in the state of nature and for these societies. So I kind of was asking myself, ending it, what's the solution? So the source of inequality is basically people come together. When you stop acting as an independent agent and come into association with some other person in some relation, then inequality is engendered. It's like, okay, well, that's pretty broad, Rousseau. You know, what's your solution to that? Which I guess is what we'll get out of the social contract. But I kind of went back and forth. At times I was kind of like, oh, why are we reading this? And I think I even put in my notes at one point, are you really going to defend that? It was the part where he talked about, he leads off with, you know, the Holy Scriptures.
That first, like, dedication is impossible. Like, I wish I had, because after that, I was completely fascinated and taken by it. But I was having really a lot of trouble at first. Like the
Yeah.
Explain what you're talking about, the first dedication.
Just the beginning of this, it begins with a dedication to the Republic of Geneva. And a lot of it sounds kind of bullshitty, like he's just trying to blow, you know, smoke up their ass and...
Yes, that's true. But I have to say, I don't know what was going on scientifically at the time, but if you read his account of the evolution of society in a certain way, it's obviously fills in a lot more of the gap and is much more plausible than Hobbes or, you know, or any of the other folks, where he's actually trying to give an account of how social relations might have evolved from this primitive proto-human hunter-gatherer kind of society. Even though I think he's wrong about it, I'm much more sympathetic to it than I was to, mm-hmm, you know, this violent state of nature, perpetual war.
Yeah, my take on this dovetails with yours, Seth, because what interested me most and what I thought was valuable was his attempt to draw out the implications of just what it meant to be social, even though they're all mostly negative implications for him. So for instance, on the very near the end of the essay, he sort of, and there's a few places where he's sort of trying to sum up where he thinks inequality comes from. And in one of them, he's talking about four kinds of inequality: riches, rank, power, and merit. And even though everything is ultimately controlled by wealth, everything originates in merit. And he talks about the quote-unquote desire of being talked about and how everything comes from that. Virtues, vices, science, errors, conquerors, philosophers, everything comes from this desire for recognition. And then on the very last page of the essay, he says something to the effect that all inequality comes from the, quote, development of our faculties and advance of the human mind. So that's pretty amazing that there's something even about having a mind, right? So the sort of what precedes the social was this, you know, reflection and self-awareness. And, you know, so it reminded me of the Nietzsche that we read, The Genealogy of Morals, where sort of the mind is carved out by social hierarchy because instincts are turned inward. Mm-hmm. And then sort of looking forward to, because two episodes from now we're going to do Freud's Civilization and Its Discontents, and that's sort of really a similar theme, which is that, so the Freud's theme, which is that to, you know, to have a, to be human, to be civilized, is basically to be repressed and miserable, which sort of seems to be a direct extension of this. So the having of a mind means oppression.
Which, thinking along the Freudian and Nietzschean lines, doesn't it make you want to interpret all this, a lot of the things you were saying about social recognition being the root of everything, that this is really Rousseau talking about himself, that this is the best analysis of he has of the human psyche because he's observing himself and he's just this insecure, fruity guy?
No, because I
feel very cynical about it.
I'm in a psychology program where we read lots of the stuff that I read, you know, is this theme of the awareness of another's awareness and the effects of that and the recognition of another person. You know, the Hegelian stuff, too, is essential to one's self-consciousness. I don't think you can get around that. I don't think you can simply say you've conquered your need for recognition from others.
Let's just call this is a down payment on some future discussions. So we're going to have the Freud. We're also going to do some of Hegel's phenomenology before too long, where he will talk about self-recognition and the master-slave relationship and other things that we've alluded a little bit to here, as well as referred to directly many times in the pragmatism discussions that we had.
Oh, did we?
Mm-hmm. Yes, you were saying the difference between Kantianism overall and Hegelianism and, you know, denying or affirming the existence of the thing in itself. And
oh, yeah.
Stuff like that. So all will be revealed eventually.
We're working towards the Hegelian absolute.
Oh, God. So before we shut down, let's point a little bit toward these things in the social contract. So like Seth was saying, you know, it's like this is only 8 years later that he writes this on social contract. And we only read the first fourth of it, the first book out of four, which is, I think, the easiest. But it restates in sort of a more mature manner, a manner less pessimistic, more wanting to engage reality as it is. Some of the same issues he talks about near the end of the Discourse on Inequality. So from chapter 6 on the social pact, he says, to find a form of association that defends and protects the person and possessions of each associate with all the common strength, by means of which each person, joining forces with all, nevertheless obeys only himself and remains as free as before. Such is the fundamental problem to which the social contract furnishes the solution. So he's saying, to have a legitimate form of government, we need to, you know, this deal that we made to protect ourselves from each other, that Hobbes describes, even though the original form that we signed was a bum deal and something that the rich came up with, well, really, we do need some kind of deal like this. We need the social contract. It addresses something that, even though it's not addressing the pure state of nature, it is an improvement over the horrific violence that would result. And this is, again, why he's not a fan of revolutions and anything that would put the state into chaos. So we just need to, you know, work our way through exactly what kind of governmental system we need to put together in order to make people as free as possible within this system. And it's interesting that some of the, when he goes on in the sections following here to describe what the social contract is, it's not like we give up a limited, you know, like the way we think of it in with the Bill of Rights in America,
yeah,
that we're giving up specific freedoms in exchange for specific benefits. He really thinks that once you join in the body politic, like you are giving up, you are becoming part of the body politic. You're not just, oh, I'll go along with this. Your will is now subsumed to this greater will. But the greater will is supposed to be designed in such a way as to reflect the general will, right?
Yeah.
Which includes sort of what is best for everybody. And he acknowledges, and yes, it's a necessary part of that, that you're not going to agree with what the government as a whole is going to come up with all the time, but you're still obliged to follow it. You have bought into it. So it really comes down as sort of a more traditional view of the social contract. Hobbes ends up saying, it's such a bad scene out there that we just give up all our rights to the monarch who himself can govern us however he wants, so long as there is a power there that is controlling this anarchy. Whereas Rousseau sets a much more difficult task for the government, maybe even an unobtainable task. One of the footnotes here said that ultimately, if you took him seriously, this was one aspect of the doctrine that led Rousseau's native Geneva to condemn on social contract as destructive of all governments. Right. And they're referring specifically in this footnote here to the fact that he was against a constitution, that really a direct democracy has to give citizens complete control of the government. They should be able to sort of remake things from the ground up, that there can't be a law that is above the general rule like the constitution is. Although you could argue, sure, we have a democratic process for amending the constitution. So
right.
Maybe we fulfill. It's a little unclear whether we're obeying that or not. And so, of course, this raises problems that then the rest of the book has to address for what about tyranny of the majority? It seems like the general will, at least if you had run a direct democracy, like you're going to get the minority persecuted all the time. And he thinks that the evil that really comes from, it's not democracy itself. It's the fact that people divide into factions, right? They make sort of private deals among themselves. They play like on Survivor and they team up.
That it's no longer really the general will when it does that, right?
Yep,
general will sort of is by definition the right, the goodwill. And you know, he refers to society, right, at one point as a public person. So the collective will is that public person's will. They would necessarily have their own interests at heart, which means the interests of everyone. And so it could only be when one faction is oppressing another that that doesn't really count as the general will.
So you could see like Tea Partiers reading the discourse on inequality and being sympathetic. Yeah, all these goddamn society is just screwing everything up. But then if they went on and read this, they would say, no, we don't like what he's come up with.
Right.
We don't want to subsume our property rights to the general will. Because certainly Rousseau is not above distributing property. Great inequalities will need to be evened out. You just can't have horrible inequalities persisting and have a peaceful society.
Right.
So this whole concept of the general will, I don't even want to build up. I don't even want to spend the time like, oh, and this is how he builds up and argues to the concept of the general will. Because I'm not even sure when he introduces it, he doesn't just throw it out there. But this idea that A, there is such a thing as a general will. B, that the sovereign can't have an interest contrary to the individuals in the body politic that compose it. Right. I have never, ever, ever been sympathetic to that concept. And I find it completely ridiculous and naive that there may be something that's common interest, namely that in the same way that an individual has self-preservation as one of the basic instincts, that a body politic may also have self-preservation. And you might say, okay, well, the common interest of this body politic is its own self-preservation and flourishing. But the differences between peoples inside the body politic makes to me the concept of a general will that goes beyond anything, beyond self-preservation, does not make any sense. And then he has a phrase in here that I find absolutely stunningly incomprehensible, which is, in order that the social compact may not be an empty formula, it tacitly includes the undertaking that whoever refuses to obey the general will shall be compelled to do so by the whole body. This means nothing less than that he will be forced to be free.
Oh yeah, I like that.
Yes.
Forced to be free.
Forced to be free.
And I think the explanation that he gives, or the only thing in there that seemed to make it at all clear what he was talking about, sounded very much like Kant, that if we cannot sort of see our own desires and wants objectively,
right,
in other words, control our appetites and rule them with reason in some way, which in this case means doing what is in accordance with the general rule and not just what I want right now, then we are not truly free. We are slaves of our passions. We're slaves of our lower selves.
And it goes to a fundamental paradox of any societal organization where we think we have rights, right? So if we're supposed to tolerate most forms of speech and most liberties, but we can't tolerate any sort of institutions which would threaten that very tolerance. So there is some element of coercion, right? So even if, you know, if you have a religious precept which demands that you do something that's against the law, well, you'll be forced to comply with that law because it, you know, might be considered essential to freedom, let's say. So there is that element of forcing people to do what you think is free, or, you know what I mean?
Yeah, allowing people of color into your establishment or whatever.
Right, there you go.
See, I had a slightly different read on it. He says a little bit later on after that part that I read, we must clearly distinguish natural liberty, which is bounded only by the strength of the individual, from civil liberty, which is limited by the general will, and possession, which is merely the effect of force or the right of the first occupier, from property, which can be founded only on a positive title. And this is where he enumerates the different elements that are required to call something property, which are mixing your labor and only taking as much. This is kind of where it breaks down for me, where he says, you know, well, property is, there's nobody else on it. You only take as much as you need to sustain yourself, and you mix your labor with it to cultivate it. And that at the point you do that, then we need this civil society and this general will that's somehow going to protect those interests. And suddenly it sounds a lot like we're exchanging liberty for security, or we're exchanging something, I'm not sure what, for security and law and justice, which sounds to me a lot like Hobbes. I mean, we're just going back to the same thing. It's sort of just, I didn't see where this social compact had anything to
distinguish. But I thought we were trying to have our liberty enforced, though. It's not just security for liberty, that we have to actually secure our liberty, right?
That may be the case, but how is that any different than Hobbes? Like, how has he not come full circle?
I know, it sounded very much like that. And then there's a passage which I was also really surprised by, because, I mean, it sounds like all of the stuff that, you know, he's against in the discourse on inequality, but there's a passage at the beginning of the civil state section. Although in this state he deprives himself of some advantages which he got from nature, he gains in return others so great, his faculties are so stimulated and developed, his ideas so extended, his feelings so ennobled, and his whole soul so uplifted, that did not the abuses of this new condition often degrade him below that which he left, he would be bound to bless continually the happy moment which took him from it forever, and instead of a stupid and unimaginative animal, made him an intelligent being and a man. So now in the state of nature, we have a stupid and unimaginative animal.
That's right.
I was so really it's depressed me to read this after Discourse on Equality.
Sell out.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I completely agree. That is, and he also says in there something about like higher order thinking, like basically that entering into civil society is what allows you to do things like create and appreciate art. And yeah, I don't know. I was underwhelmed by that first part of the social contract of what I thought was a pretty severe and convincing critique of the concept of how the concept of property introduces inequality into, you know, human society. I think obviously that's the stuff that everybody else picked up on.
Yeah. And I think it's necessarily contradictory, because, you know, as Mark presented in the beginning, it's sort of, okay, society sucks, you know, in the way it's sort of arises out of the state of nature, but you can make the best of a bad situation. That's what this is about. But even then, it's kind of odd that he doesn't really refer to the drawbacks that much. You know, it's not like he hasn't really integrated any of the discourse of inequality into this. Like you said, it sounds Hobbesian. It's just, you know, we're better off with the body politic and all that.
Yeah. So I guess, I mean, it's just in how the rest of the social contract essay springs out in his specific judgments on different types of governments is where we're going to see the biggest differences with Hobbes.
Yeah. Right.
But we're not going to talk about that. So the end. Stay tuned for next time. We will continue this discussion by talking about Spinoza's ethics. Oh, okay. Well, actually, that's not very relevant to this. But that'll be fun too, right?
Well, the one after that will be sort of civilization and its discontents.
A little bit, yeah.
Quite a bit, you know?
Now, I thought I had read Spinoza's ethics, but the English translation that I have, which is actually called The Ethics of Spinoza, and I looked at, compared it with the online version of Spinoza Ethics that I linked to, and it's totally like reorganized and highly edited. And wow, I don't think I've actually read Spinoza's Ethics based on this realization. So I'm looking forward to it. It's some wacky stuff. So the listeners are thinking we're going to be talking more about ethics. The subtitles of it are Of God, Of Nature and the Origin of Mind, Of the Origin and Nature of the Affects, right, the emotions, Of Human Bondage or the Power of the Affects, Of the Power of the Intellect or of Human Freedom. So not exactly about what we might think of as ethics, at least not directly. It's a whole metaphysical system and our place in the world, and he's really just a very nice big picture philosopher. So that'll be fun, and yeah, if it gets too long, just read the beginning and we'll see where we run out of steam. We'll post exactly what we read on the blog, partiallyexaminedlife.com. please go look at it. You can follow us on Twitter. You can comment on the blog posts. Look at, you can subscribe. You can have emails sent to you with these wonderful posts. We've just added some content by one of our guest podcasters, Eric Douglas, who wrote a very long essay on something. We had a bunch of video postings. There's music and things up there. Lots of good stuff. There's also the Facebook discussion group. And why don't you go on iTunes and give us a positive review if you liked what you heard here. And spread the word, eh? Tell your friends. So that's all I got. Thanks to both of you.
All right.
Thank you.
Chilling.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Just let out of jail, or visiting the country, or learning how to fail. And if you get your basic needs all met, then you can concentrate on what really matters. Love is the problem that you can't ignore. Love is the problem that you're looking for. Just find someone. Ask around about friends of friends, about exes of exes of exes of yours. Just find someone who can stand to be near you, who has similar needs. Could that be so hard? Love is the problem that you can't ignore. Love is the problem that you're looking for. Is the problem that you can't ignore. Love is the problem that you're looking for. And if you're lucky, all your time will disappear, and you'll never have to fear. And if you're lucky, all your interests will dissolve in the life you'll have to solve. And if you're lucky, all your cares will multiply as your years go tearing by. Cause you found someone. That you're fading fast. Love.